Hey folks, thanks for tuning in. This episode of Off Camera is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace recently launched the latest version of their platform, Squarespace 7, which has a completely redesigned interface, integrations with Getty Images and Google Apps, 15 new templates, and an incredible feature called Cover Pages. Try the new Squarespace with a free trial at squarespace.com. And for a 10% discount, enter our offer code OFFCAMERA at the checkout page. Squarespace. Start here, go anywhere. Hello and welcome to another edition of Off Camera. I'm your host, Sam Jones. And in this episode, I sit down with singer-songwriter Taylor Goldsmith. Some artists do what they do because it's simply impossible for them to do anything else. Meet Exhibit A. At just 28, Taylor Goldsmith, the songwriter and frontman of LA-based band Dawes, is already hailed as one of our most mature songcrafters. His work has been compared not only to some of the greatest classic authors, whom he reads avidly, but also to some of the musical poets who inspire him. Bob Dylan, Jackson Browne, Robbie Robertson, and Warren Zevon, many of whom he has had the opportunity to record and tour with. Goldsmith grew up in a musical household and has played music with his brother Griffin, who is the drummer in Dawes, since age 10. He appears to somehow have sprung from the womb with an almost fully developed sound and lyrical approach. He stayed true to both while still managing to evolve over Dawes' last three albums. So, who better to discuss the mysterious process of songwriting than one of its most authentic and thoughtful practitioners? What experience informs a great song and makes its story valid over time? What role should the writer's life experience play in a song? And if great songs are deeply personal, how do they still connect with thousands? Also, why does a guy whose songs are widely associated with the Laurel Canyon sound, and who indeed recorded his band's first album in Laurel Canyon, not actually like LA that much? Whether or not you've pondered these questions, we guarantee you will enjoy the conversation. So pull up a chair and listen in. What's up, Taylor Goldsmith? Thanks for coming and doing this with me.
Thanks for having me.
I want to, by way of introduction, just recount a story of one of the first times I worked with you. We were doing a photo shoot, and we had a bunch of guitars laying around for the shoot. And at one point, you just picked up a guitar, and you started playing a song. And the crew's kind of doing their thing, and they're setting up lights, and everyone kind of stopped, and they leaned in a little bit. And you finished, and you're like, it's something I'm working on. And you know, it didn't seem strange at all to you to just pick up a guitar and play a song in the middle of a bunch of strangers that wasn't even done yet, you know? And when I think about that, I think that's what music should be. It should be more of a communication or the sharing of a melody. It shouldn't have to be the perfect environment and everyone look at me. And I think all my favorite musicians have that quality, that they can pick up whatever's laying around. They don't need the perfect mic or the perfect room. And they can make a piece of music. You know what I mean? And I think you have that. And so anyway, I'm a big fan.
No, it's cool to hear that. I mean, someone even recently was telling me, you know, when I'm working on something, when I get close to finishing it, I hate it. And you don't seem to do that. You seem to not hate it. You seem to be willing to show it. At first, my reaction was sort of like, I hope I don't come off like some, you know, arrogant guy that wants to just show everyone what he's been up to. Because it's not that. I feel like I have just as much uncertainty and even insecurities with my work as anybody else, because it's never good enough, nor should it be. But it is something where, like, I'm proud of it. I feel like that's, like you said, it's me showing a side of me that I'm not good at showing otherwise. And right. So if I'm in a room of people I don't know and they say, hey, play a song, or even if they don't say, hey, play a song, I feel like, oh, here's, like, this is who I am, and take it or leave it.
I have a lot of friends like that John Bryan is a good example. He can't not pick up an instrument at any dinner party or whatever it is. He's going to end up playing, and probably for hours, and I think it's because
That's how he communicates.
Yeah. It's funny. I've had, people will say, like a email or a text message, it allows you to really pause and get your thoughts in order. And sometimes trying to have more in-depth conversations through a text or something is sort of frowned upon. But sometimes I think writing a song is like the ultimate version of that, where it's like you really, you're sort of unearthing things, and all of a sudden your things are making sense to you that you weren't even quite aware of.
I heard your father was a musician as well. Was that kind of an environment that was fairly normal to you growing up? Just people playing music and...
Definitely. I mean, it was my father, myself, and my brother Griffin, who were just more musically inclined. Our mom, loved having it around, but she's not a musical person. And we grew up, it's still the same way in holidays. Like we'll all sit at the piano or pick up a guitar and we'll all sing harmonies with each other. It's a really fun thing. I mean, it's been a big part of why we got into it. I mean, I've seen videos of my brother and I singing harmonies together when we were, when I was 10 and he's 5. So it's like, when people say like, you guys seem to have been singing together a long time, it's for us, it's sort of like, you have no idea. It's been like, I don't remember a time when we weren't.
Right. Now, was the guitar the first instrument you picked up, or was it piano, or?
I played piano. Like I did lessons and then for like 3 years I was just kind of learning how to read, but I wasn't learning how to express myself through a piano. And then that stopped because it was a pretty empty experience for me. And then I think that was when I was like 9 or something. And then when I was 11 or 12, I picked up a guitar. And then from learning just a few chords and what that consisted of, then I was able to go back to the piano and actually, it's funny because it was my second time coming to the piano, but I felt like it was really my first time with it. And then that's when I really started to play piano. And then for a while, piano was more my main instrument.
Oh, it was?
Than guitar, yeah. Well, being in a band with that guy, Blake Mills, it was just sort of like, what space am I going to fill and really bring something to it? And so I ended up playing piano a lot more.
Well, you mentioned Blake, and you two were in a band when you were very young. Simon Dawes, and now you're doing your own thing and he's doing his, but I find it fascinating that both of you you've made your own paths, but you're both very successful doing wildly different things. I mean, what do you think contributed to that early on? Like, that you two found each other and it's like you don't see that all the time when usually one friend kind of, you go, that's the one that's really going places. And you guys both went places, but ended up going different places.
Well, and I think that's something that we were able to pick up on, I think, even watching his off-camera interview when he talks about kind of like depending on all facets of his musical career to inspire the others to go on tour in order to be excited to get back in the studio or to go do a session in order to go home and be excited to write a song. I think he was becoming aware of that really quickly. And when we were a band in 2006, 2007, that's when we were first hitting the road. You don't have a shot if you're not willing to tour all the time. And so I think that was like, that wasn't working for him. Whereas for me and for just Dawes as a band, it was I don't think that I could like just kind of be in LA and be able to put together any sort of success as just a LA player. For me, it was like, I feel like I've learned my trade as much as I can, and I think it's songwriting more than anything else. It's not really being a piano player. It's not really being a guitar player. It's not really being a singer. And so if that's what my trade is, the only place I could take that is on the road. We were both sort of learning that at the same time, like the environment that we both needed in order to really feel like ourselves. And also like when you talk about, two friends that are both kind of doing what they want and in a cool place with their careers, I think that that, you know, in some cases, yeah, you do see one guy sort of, you know, blast off into space and the other guy kind of not. But I think for us, I mean, at least I know for me and my feelings for him, it's always been so inspiring, you know, to have someone like that in my life. Like I'm still chasing Blake Mills in a really, you know, in a loving way. I consider him like a brother.
Well, that's interesting because to me, I could make the argument that you went off, put out records, you've built this whole thing around Dawes, and you're this band. You're on the radio and doing these big shows. And Blake is kind of like we know who he is, yeah. And people in the know in LA know he's a heavy, heavy yeah. session cat guy, right? But he doesn't have that same thing. So I'm sure he could sit there and go, look at Taylor out there on the right. road and he's doing his thing. So
and may that always be the way it is for sure. everybody, just to see another thing. Like, how do I incorporate that? I mean, like the level of respect a guy like Blake would get for being a musician. Yeah, I mean, it's like we see that. It's like, whoa, that would be so cool to have people like, oh, have you heard the new stuff? And yeah, and I'm sure that like he comes to Dawes. I mean, he plays whenever we're together, like at a festival, whatever it is. He'll play with us, and I'm sure that there are times where we're in front of enough people where he will think to himself, like, you know, I could get used to this. I would like this to be a bigger part of my career, and you know, hopefully at some point it will be.
You know, in terms of songwriters you admire and songs that you gravitate towards, do you more gravitate to ones where you feel like this is completely autobiographical, and I'm hearing this person's. You know, I'm hearing his inner voice, or are you more someone who gravitates towards a really well-crafted song?
It's a good question. I mean, I think that there's, you know, great examples of both. There's sometimes where I listen to a record and every single song is from me to you. Like, it's the same perspective, the same heartbreak, and that ends up being the strength. Where it's like, wow, this is such a period, this is such a time in a person's life and something that's really, you know, hitting them hard. In terms of like song crafting, it might not really be the most revolutionary or exciting thing. It just happens to be truly emotive and compelling just because it's like, wow, they're putting it out on the table. And then other times I will be you know, over the moon for someone who's just knows how to write a great song. Like one of my favorite songs ever is The French Inhaler by Warren Zevon. It's so emotional. You know, saying like, when the lights came up at 2, I caught a glimpse of you and your face looked like something death brought with it in a suitcase. And it's funny, but it's also heavy. And growing up in LA, it's sort of like, wow, this is an experience I really can relate to. But it's not about Warren Zevon. It's about, I mean, at the end he says, in a letter that she wrote, it says, "So long, Norman," and then it all becomes clear, like, oh, this is about Marilyn Monroe and Norman Mailer, supposedly. I'm sure his own experience informed the writing of the song, as any personal experience would do for anybody's songwriting. But it was sort of like, wow, he was able to really get, like, really break my heart, and yet it's not his story.
Right.
And that's something that it's hard to do. And it's a way for him to give an identity to his song. And so, you know, there's a lot to be said for both. And I, you know, cause I don't care about how good something is on paper or by a certain criteria that someone else is imposing. Like, I remember when I would read Henry Miller books, I was sort of like, wow, this guy is so bad at telling a story, but he's so good at writing that I don't care that this is kind of just him rambling. Like, there's not really a clear arc here. These characters are kind of coming and going, and there's no talking about anybody else other than himself, and yet I'm just obsessed. So it's like, and if that happens in a song where it's like, wow, this guy doesn't know how to put a chorus together, or this guy doesn't know how to sing, or whatever it is, it's sort of like, I don't really mind as long as... it's, you know, punch me in the gut or like give me a big hug.
It just has to get you on one level.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think also that, you know, you take a guy like Warren Zevon, and who I love, And you get to a certain point in songwriting, and maybe you don't want to keep telling your story over again. And I know you're a big reader, and I think that some of the artists I admire a lot, like Leonard Cohen and Dylan and Zevon, I think that it becomes a case of, well, these characters are there, and there's so much life in them. Why don't I write about that? Yeah. And then, yeah, your voice always comes through.
Well, and also, I think a big thing for songwriters, and you know, I've been young and dumb and been a victim of it myself, but it is a medium. It is an artistic medium where it's easy to stay autobiographical. It's easy to really revel in the heartache, and it's effective if you can do it, you know, gracefully, without being like, you know, overly manipulative, because I can like pick up a guitar and say like, I wish she was here. And like, that doesn't necessarily, that might not even be true, but someone's gonna be like, oh, that guy seems like he's going through something. That hurts a little bit, but that doesn't make it a good song necessarily. But I think it can be easy for a songwriter to stay in an autobiographical place, but that can be dangerous. I feel like, at least for me, I've grown up watching myself lose relationships with friends, with women, like becoming much more introverted or solitary, and it in a way it was like, because I was always so blinded by looking for the next song, where like, you know, 6 months or a year would go by where I happened to be in a good place, and all of a sudden I'm not writing music, so I you know, kick a bunch of dust into the air and sort of like obliterate a good thing I have going in order to like get back to the drawing board.
Sure.
And for me, it's been important. Like, it's important to me to learn how to go to that place, how to make good music without, like, you know, me being on the table. Like, I don't
exactly.
I don't need to be under the knife in order to draw something out and make it compelling. That can emotionally damage somebody. Because you feel obligated to serve this impression that you feel like others have of you. And that's totally ridiculous. But it's something that you can easily fall victim to, I feel like.
Sure, especially if you think, well, if I don't do that, I'll lose the success I had or
right.
something. So you start chasing it because you think that's what people that like me want of me.
Yeah, which I feel like is the most evil place a band or an artist in any way could ever get. Because when I think of like, how do I make sure that people are getting what they like about me? It's like you're signing your death certificate, I feel like. When I look at so many artists that I love, like I was even talking to someone recently about Bob Dylan saying, they were saying, you know what, like, I don't like Blood on the Tracks, I don't like Desire, I don't like the later stuff. I really love the protest early stuff where it's a little more conscious of culture and society and really has like a clearer message. And I was sort of like, that's cool. That's your shit that you love by him. That's awesome. But I feel like if he stayed the guy that you are talking about loving, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
No.
He would have been gone a long time ago. You look at every guy that has stuck around, and that's always the case. It's always reinventing yourself. It's always pissing people off in order to, you know, to add to the conversation, add to the dialogue between the artist and the audience. And once you say, well, that's not what people like me for, you're out of the game.
It's just not natural. But you do. You see artists all the time, especially songwriters, that keep trying to write the same record.
Yeah.
And eventually, the thing that we thought was new and original becomes the thing that imprisons them.
Yeah, and it's a hard lesson to learn. I mean, like, you know, we've had people say, like, oh, your first record, North Hills, it's so meaningful to me. It's like my favorite of yours. And I appreciate that. And there is an impulse of like, oh, well, then how do I make sure that you love the next thing? Should I re-listen to that, take something into account that I haven't been? And the answer is no. And the answer is thank you for loving that, and I hope that you fall in love with the later stuff or the stuff after that or whatever it is in a way that that you didn't with the earlier stuff. And if you never do, that's okay.
When we talk about the autobiographical sort of nature, if I wanted to look at your catalog so far, what song or songs do you think are the most autobiographical, where it's like we're listening to you working something out? I mean, are there ones that stand out as that's where I was playing it straight and I wasn't being a character, or I wasn't, you know what I mean? It just kind of came out as me.
Well, I mean, it shifts, you know, like there's lines in it. We have a song called Love Is All I Am, and there's lines in that when I'm singing it now, I'm like, oof, I wouldn't write that now. That's not me.
But it was really you when you wrote it.
It's coming from me, and it didn't cross my mind as like, you know, like it didn't hit me like, wait, this isn't accurate. This isn't representing you, in a true way. And I think a lot of songs are like that, where, I mean, we have a song called Coming Back to a Man, where the main line is, you broke the quick given heart of a kid, but now you're coming back to a man. And we finished that song the other night, and it just, as I was singing it, you know, trying to get in touch with the song like I always do, and I, after saying that line, and we finished the song, I said, man, I wish that song was more true about me than I think it really is.
Really?
Like, to make an assumption like, yeah, I've figured it out, and like, fuck you, you know, it's just like,
that's funny you say that, because what I take from that song is, it brings up the question, is there one moment in every young man's coming of age existence where you go from that open-hearted person to you get your heart broken and you can never quite get back to that guy again?
Yeah, well, that song I feel like is still very true for me, where it's someone who I gave myself to so willingly and so foolishly, perhaps, and then have that kind of fall apart, and it's like, whoa, like I was given my trust around to like whoever asked for it, and like that's it ended up backfiring and hurting me. But you know, one song that I feel like is most true in this conversation of what we're talking about for me is a song called Something in Common, which is on our latest record. Mm-hmm. Specifically because I feel like it's referring to this, where it's saying the man standing in front of you is not the sum of all his dreams, but I hope they have something in common. Where it is getting to the conversation of, it's almost an impossible question to answer when you say like, you know, what's the most you? And I feel like that song is sort of dealing with that. It's like, sometimes I don't even know. But when you really start to think about the parts of us that we don't understand, it could be pretty epic.
Well, I think that song, I love that song. And I think what I take away from that is, I hope that if I said something to you last year, that I'm still, that's part of me. And maybe I've grown and changed, but my general direction is true. And my general, you know, moral center has not changed.
Right.
And like I said, you grow older and you grow wiser, and you maybe amend some of the things you thought were like throwing your trust around. But in the end, you don't want to be a guy that doesn't trust anybody either, right? You hope that the open-hearted kid and the person who's had his heart beaten down a couple times still have something in common.
Right.
You don't want to lose the good things about that thing too.
Right.
You know? I want to jump back a little bit just to your brother, because you already mentioned earlier that you've been singing since you were so young, but I've known a couple sets of brothers, and the way they sing together is fascinating. And you know, I think there's something very special about that, you know, that sibling thing where you just kind of intrinsically know how you're going to sing with somebody, and there's something genetically about your voice. Let's listen to a good example, not only for the brother and brother harmony and one of the first songs I ever heard you guys do, but it also brings up another theme that I hear in your songwriting. So let's listen to this.
Right. Take me out of the city where my shadow can roam. Let me breathe
that was one of my first exposures to your band, and that tight harmony I'm a sucker for anyway. But I also, when I hear that, I hear this sort of, there's many themes in many of your songs about Los Angeles and either needing to get away from it or being wary of its soul stealing powers, or something. And in that one, it's take me out of the city, you know, presumably so you can clear your head and breathe a little bit.
Right.
And I'm from here also. And I think what I hear is almost like there's this homelessness, because when you're in LA, you can't really find that home feeling, but then when you're away, you can't either.
Yeah.
I mean, is that a recurring theme for you, or has it been?
Definitely. And it's funny because with that song that's on our first record, that's before Dawes ever played outside of LA. So I think a big thing then was kind of like, you know, this city can really beat someone up, and it really, you know, I mean, like any major city around the world, it's got a we've seen too much kind of attitude at times. And that can be disheartening. It can be inspiring if you're in a good enough place within yourself, but it can also be like, man, like, I'm just the next dude. Like, I mean, everybody does what I do, and why would I get more of a shot than anybody else? And so I was scared, and we wanted to really, like, you know, take the show on the road, really. And then once we did that with our second record and our third record, there is a little more insight into the relationship that I have with LA. I mean, it's a really complicated one. There's every time I hear a Los Angeles song, and I'm sure, you know, that goes for anybody living wherever they're, or anybody hearing a song about wherever they're from.
But, you know, it's funny, fast forward to, your second record, and you're saying, it seems my friends don't seem to know me without my suitcase in my hand.
Yeah.
And it's like now you've been doing this road thing, and you see Los Angeles maybe from the other side as well, which is, you know, when you're standing here, you seem to disappear. So I think that's an interesting thing to look at.
Well, it's funny because I feel like Take Me Out of the City, that song was sort of saying, I'm tired of this hardness. I'm tired of this broken heart that I see in so many people that seems to be common throughout, everyone I meet out here. And then I leave and I miss it. I go to some places where, I mean, I don't want to ever generalize about like another place, but I definitely have had that feeling before of like, you know what, like folks in LA don't get this excited. And it's a way that makes me feel at home. And as sad and ugly as that might sound, it's special to me, you know, like that's like, I think that everybody kind of gives, everything a second glance out here. And I've grown up on it, you know, I've grown up on people doubting how great something really is. Right. And I think that adds a value. It's hard to really put it into words, the like growing up in a place like this, but I don't know how else to say it.
Well, I kind of hear you saying, like, it took leaving to realize the value of growing up here in some ways.
Yeah, totally. I mean, and it's something that I can, I mean, that's what that song Time Spent in Los Angeles is about, where it's something that it's ineffable, but it's something that I could recognize in someone else. Like, you know, if you were to have asked me before I knew that you were from LA, like, where do you think I'm from? I probably wouldn't just known. I probably would have been like, you know, you're a Los Angeles, California boy, and I don't know how else to tell you that I knew other than I knew.
You'll hear more of this off-camera conversation after a short break.
Hey folks, Sam Jones here. I don't know if you've ever tried to build a website, but it can be tough. And even if you do know your way around coding, creating something that looks good and works good is a time-consuming affair. But the thing is, you probably need one anyway. A business site, a portfolio, a restaurant, whatever else. Well, lucky for us, now there is Squarespace, where you can build beautiful websites without breaking a sweat. Haven't heard of it? Well, go to squarespace.com and check it out. And even if you do know about it, take some time to get into the new Squarespace 7, which comes with a newly designed interface and 15 new templates, but so much more too. If you're thinking about Squarespace for work, it now integrates Google Apps so you can connect it to your Gmail, Google Drive for cloud storage, Google Forms for surveys on your site, and more. And if you need extra polish, Squarespace now has partnered with Getty Images, so you can take care of all your stock image needs in the same place you manage your site. I mean, they've really got this stuff down. Beautiful design, 24/7 support, responsive design, and every website comes with a free online store. Best thing of all, it's only $8 a month, and you get a free domain if you buy Squarespace for the year. Start a trial with no credit card required, and start building your website today. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code OFFCAMERA to get 10% off your first purchase. And it shows support for our show. We thank Squarespace for their support of Off Camera. Squarespace. Start here. Go anywhere.
And now, back to the conversation.
I want to say that when I first heard of you guys, it was someone who told me, oh man, they're like the band. They got these harmonies and they harken back to that first generation of those guys. And a lot of that's true. I mean, you guys definitely make music that, makes older guys be like, yeah, why aren't there more young whippersnappers doing, but I think that it's important to write about your environment and not try to write about something that you don't experience. So maybe even though you had this sound of, whatever the band or Woodstock or there was some elements of that, I think you've always written about your experience here and you haven't tried to hide it and say, well, I'm really from,
right,
the Midwest, or I'm back East, or whatever it is,
Right. It's a weird thing because not only is it a different time, but it's a different place sometimes. Some people are like, oh, you don't sound like an LA band. It's like, well, okay. We didn't really think about geography when we were making our records. And then the cool thing was that it did, at least, by our tastes or in our own opinions, we did sound like LA. Like there are so many records that our stuff sort of is referential to, Neil Young, Jackson Browne, sure, Joni Mitchell, Warren Zevon, guys that were from here. And a lot of people want to say like, oh no, it's a little too country, it's a little too acoustic-y or something for it to seem like it's from LA. But I think that songwriters in LA have always had a romantic relationship with a world that they don't find here. I also, look, for us, like when we, like it's weird to hear like that we sound like an old thing because we can't. We just do what we do. We can't.
Sure.
Really, we can't.
Sure.
And that's something that I think about quite a bit. Where it's like, I want to be honest. I want to be real, but I also want to be relevant.
Well, maybe that's an old thing, to want to be honest and real.
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess what I'm saying is that for really young guys, you came out of the gate. You really understood your sound, and it came out fully formed.
Right.
You know what I mean? It wasn't like you found that sound over a few records. And look, you've recorded with Jackson Browne, you've recorded with Robbie Robertson, you've toured with Bob Dylan. I mean, talk about getting close to your heroes.
Right, yeah.
Right, and I think there is that thing that, wow, you get this close to your heroes, how does that not rub off a little bit,
right, Yeah, I mean, it's a weird thing because you have these heroes and you emulate and you imitate. But then at the same time, you kind of lose sight of the fact that why you have these heroes is because they did something that no one ever did before.
Right.
And obviously that's a process. Bob Dylan wasn't our concept of Bob Dylan right out of the gate. He was kind of ripping off a lot of people.
Sure.
And then through that, he was able to create one of the most singular voices in songwriting that will ever be. And that's something that is that's a real dream, that to not only learn from the greats and apply it, but then to somehow, truly through no effort, it has to kind of just happen or it won't. All of a sudden, there you have your own singular voice, and then people are saying like, "Oh, this sounds like a Dawes song," and it's not a Dawes song. You know, like that's or this sounds like a song Taylor Goldsmith would write. That's the ultimate thing. Because for a while, when I was younger, the ultimate thing was, "Oh, Taylor, your song that sounds like a Bob Dylan song," and or that sounds like a Warren Zevon song or whatever it was. I'd be like, "Wow, it really that really means a lot to me." But now I'm like when. I'm you know, if someone likes our music and they want to say it sounds like a Bob Dylan song, I'm still honored.
Yeah.
But now the real dream is you know what, that this other song that you didn't write sounds like you.
Yeah. Well, look, I think on the second record, I felt like, my God, how does a guy at this age write with such a profound individualism, and like he has been around, like I think what I'm trying to say is you're a very old soul inside. You know what I mean? Like I feel like the song I'm talking about is Moon in the Water. When I hear that from the arrangement and from the themes and the tone of the record, it sounds like a person that this is his 10th record, not his second or third record, you know? In fact, let me play a little bit of that, because I want to ask you about that too.
I can feel you in the heat. I can taste you in the air. And I can't help but find your face in everything I see. And once I can admit you're gone, I'll place it on a star and wait for the day I'm what you need. Then reach out for your heart. 'Cause even if love is more my mistress than my lovers ever are, you'll always be.
The thing about that song that gets me so much is that as mature as it is, there's this thing that songwriters have, and the best ones do it to me, where it's always worthwhile to keep reaching for something beyond your grasp a little bit, or to keep hoping that that thing exists. I mean, it's the same thing as just appreciating beauty in anything.
Right.
And that song really grabs it for me because it seems to roll off your tongue so easily. It doesn't seem like a crafted song, which I know it is, because that's all, a song is like that good is hard to write, but it seems like it's straight from the heart, you know? When you finished that, did you feel like I have something here?
Yeah, I mean, you know, since we're between us girls, like, yeah, when I finished that song, I was like, I think this is my best one. And like, I mean, you know, if I tried to downplay that or try to, you know, maintain some sort of sense of modesty, I would be lying to you. Because that when I finished that one, I was like proud. And all of us artists have those moments. It was funny though, because it's never been like a definitive song of ours.
No one's pulled it out.
No one, when we play a more like obvious hooky song, like When My Time Comes or A Little Bit of Everything, which isn't hooky, but just it happens to just be a song that resonates in a certain way. That'll like get cheers before the song even really starts. Whereas Moon in the Water, it never clicked over like that. And it's funny because it just goes back to what we were talking about earlier, like an artist's relationship with their work. Is so different than how it's received. And I mean, you know, for you to want to play that song, I'm thrilled. It's like, oh, cool, that song doesn't come up that much. But it is funny because when I got that song done, I was like, this is I feel like it unfolds in a way that I'm proudest of. And it bordered on, I really questioned a lot of lyrics in it because I was like, this is really me, and like, and I don't know how proud I am of these parts of me that I'm really being honest about. Like to say,
love is more my mistress
than my lovers ever are. It's like, but it's definitely, if not still, it was true at the time where there was an idea that I was chasing, or I would. You know, meet someone, and then it would become an image that wasn't fair to uphold these people to, and and I wasn't having real conversations. It was sort of like I was living in my head, and I was looking for something that wasn't attainable.
Well, it's a mature thing to be able to say, maybe I've set the bar too high, and I'm requiring too much of my lovers. But at the same time, I really love that idea, and I love that feeling of the idea that that's out there, and that's something to keep searching for. That's what I take it from that song, that it is sort of a contradiction in some ways, but it's a true contradiction that we all feel. Like, yes, we have to compromise, and we have to find ways to, you know, ways to accept people and all that. But at the same time, deep down, I think we all just want to be really loved and seen for who we are.
Yeah.
You know, it's that thing.
Yeah, I mean, I was truly in love with the idea of what my lover was going to be like, what I was going to be like to them. And even in the next song on that record, there's that line in a song called The Way You Laugh, true lovers always end up lonely because they know how good it could be, which is totally not fair. Totally not true, but it is something where if it's, you know, taken in a certain context, like the way I meant that was, we can be lonely with others, you know, we don't have to be, I didn't mean alone, I meant lonely. And I think that sometimes we can get a little carried away with our dreams, of what something was supposed to be. But I think I was finally learning that about myself. I was learning, I need to embrace the real world a little more. I need to learn how to not expect so much of myself, to not expect so much of the world around me, to, you know, like the way things really are, in a way that growing up with my nose in a book or like my headphones on and being taught by these heroes of mine that had such a heightened sense of romance that it became a little deceptive, and I was sort of living in a world or at least living with expectations that were just not real. And I don't just mean in terms of like the girl that I would meet. I just meant in terms of the way
life's supposed to look. Fold,
yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, look. I think the reason art is created in the first place is because you get only so far with reality, and then you want to feel that extra thing. I mean, look, the reason we have art, and I think the reason we love it so much is because it's not reality.
Yeah.
And it's something a little bit more, and I think without those examples, you may not have wanted to go do this. You know, like, you need the example of what it can be.
Yeah.
I think.
No, definitely. That's a cool way to put it.
And you know what, the thing about that song, Moon in the Water, is that I don't care how old you get or how many more records you write, it is a pretty accurate feeling and a pretty universal feeling. And it doesn't matter if, you know, I'm a guy who's been married for 10 years listening to that. I'm not going, oh, he doesn't know what he's talking about. I'm going, oh, yeah, I felt that and I feel it. And
yeah.
That's, I think when you write a song that transcends, it has that thing. You tap into something that everybody feels. And they may not talk about it, but I think everybody feels that to some extent.
Right. Yeah, it's a hard thing to talk about. And like, I guess I've never had that filter until, you know, after the fact. Sometimes, I mean, you know, even in this interview, there might be a moment where I say something and I'll just say, wait, what? I'm not supposed to talk about this stuff. This is not socially acceptable. And I've always been that way. And I think that's why I'll say stuff like that in a song, and it won't occur to me till later, like, well, I played my hand a little too hard, I think. but I'm learning to if not, I don't know, I guess I'm learning to use it, or learning to be proud of it, or I guess mainly just accepting it about me.
We're very similar. And you know what? The guys that are good at doing that dinner party conversation, they can have that. They can have that point. I'm always going to be the guy that shares, and I'm glad you are too. I've been recently really looking at the, you know, not the business side of music so much, but the way now that people listen and the way they experience bands, and there's been a sea change in the whole approach to being a fan. When I was young, there are certain records that I could tell you exactly where I was the first time I heard them. I could tell you exactly how they made me feel, what they made me want to do. You know, if whether it was Blonde on Blonde or Ziggy Stardust or Pink Moon or Sticky Fingers, like I heard these records and the entire story of the record stuck with me. And it was almost in some ways like a sort of a life plan, you know, like, oh, okay, here's people that understand me and can show me the way. And mm-hmm. And now, you know, I feel like people would argue that the album is dead and people just go out and find the songs. And if they want to find out about Dawes, they can go to Spotify, they can type in Dawes, they can go to Most Popular. And this whole beautiful thing of crafting a record and a sequence and everything is changing.
Yeah.
I do wonder from the other standpoint of some of these artists just going, well, what's the point? You know, like, we make a record and no one, you know, we can't get people to listen to it, or we can't get people to hear the sixth song down. And,
right.
You know, I guess I just wonder, you know, if you guys were doing this 20, 30 years ago, there would be an income associated with that. And there would be a...
That isn't there now.
Yeah, and there would be a time associated with it that you were allowed to develop to some extent, to where you're going to build a fan base that can sustain you, and then the very act of royalties and record sales will sustain you. And now I just think, in some ways I just feel like what a hard thing any artist has at this point to know how to sustain a long career and how to do that. I mean, do you ever just stop and say, how do we do this differently in a way that we can get to the people that want to hear us and we can keep doing it?
That's true. We all have our own version of this, but I definitely think, how is this going to be feasible or sustainable in 5 years or in 10 years? Sometimes I get really fired up by it because I think, you know, maybe this is closer to the way it was supposed to be in the first place, rather than, you know, millions of dollars coming in for record sales. I mean, we're troubadours again, you know.
Yeah.
We're hitting the road. We're taking these songs out there, and we're minstrels, you know, and it's back. And I think that's cool. I think, you know, I'm 28, so I can do that right now. I want to still be a professional musician when I'm 50. I couldn't tour as hard as I do now when
right.
I'm 50. So, you know, we all live modestly. We don't have large incomes. I mean, we're very grateful. We're very lucky, and you know, we're able to make a living off music. So to just say that
sure.
we won, it's a victory right now. And so, but at the same time, yeah, we're not the rich rock stars that maybe a band our size 30 years ago would be. Not when, you know, again, we're not like a big famous band, but there were, you didn't have to necessarily be a big famous band in a certain time to really make a good amount of money. And, but I don't care. I don't care about that as much. I mean, sometimes I feel like I should, or that I should want to, but I just feel like a band 30 years ago would be scared of the same things. Like, we're all scared of things falling apart, and like, how am I going to be able to sustain this? How am I going to be able to, like, you know, all that fear of annihilation, like, puts on a different mask for everybody. And so, you know, now that the way that a guy like me looks at it is, no one buys records. Everybody's on tour. It's the market's oversaturated. My music is not where the culture's at anymore. You know, there's all these different things that I can get that give fear to.
Sure.
And it's really just I have to find ways to constantly remind myself. I get to write songs and play shows for a living, and if that all ended tomorrow, and were to go away, I would be able to say, I'm so lucky that I got to, until I was 28, I got to act like a 17-year-old.
Well, I think that's obviously a great attitude to have towards it, you know? And I think there's also, you know, a lot of talk about the single, or about how artists have to just kind of constantly release stuff if they want to stay relevant, which is sort of different than what you're talking about. But do you ever think that you'll see a point where you're just sort of putting out almost EP-sized things, where three or four songs, and then, you know what I mean? Or do you think that you'll always try to focus on this idea of a record, of a statement?
I think for the music that I respond to, the music I want to write, I think it depends on the context of records. I think some people, like, their music does, you know, a song stands on its own where it doesn't need to be, you know, shuffled around with 10 other songs in order to give it power. But I feel like a lot of my favorite records, like Beggar's Banquet, if Dear Doctor was released as a single, I would sort of be like, I don't know what's going on, Rolling Stones. This is kind of like, it's cool, but there's no context here. Whereas when it's in Beggar's Banquet, it's one of my favorite tracks, because the fact that the heaviness of Sympathy for the Devil or Street Fine Man or Jigsaw Puzzle, that gives context to Dear Doctor, and that gives power to Dear Doctor. And those are the records I always end up loving, and those are the records I want to make. I want to make records that have songs that depend on each other for strength and for reference, you know?
Yeah, you're right. I think it's something that I never really considered until you said it, which is, music used to be part of the popular culture in a intellectual way, mm-hmm. like the latest Thomas Pynchon book would be, or mm-hmm. or, you know, the New York Times, what made the front page of the New York Times on Sunday or whatever. And it's been marginalized and fragmented.
Yeah. And that doesn't have to be bad. You know, like when I think maybe I'm just doing this to protect myself and to you know, make sure that I don't, you know, break down into tears or something. But I've thought, like, you know, I'd rather be a marginal band. I'd rather be on the fringe of things, if that's what it means to really feel like I want to hang out with all my fans, like all of our fans. You know, like I at a Dawes show, I look out and I think I want to relate to people that, you know, from my impression of them is in terms of like how they're responding to me and just like their age. I think to myself, like, this, I want to get to know these people. Whereas, you know, that could easily not be the case. Like I could be writing these Dawes songs and for some reason, the only people that it resonates are between 11 and 13. And then I'm sort of like, what does this mean? Like, what am I getting after stuff that really, you know, only appeals to someone who's like, just awakening their conscious mind? Or because when it's someone that's when I look out and I see people that I feel like I'm one of, that's like, oh, this is cool. I don't care if it's 600 people instead of 6,000. I mean, it would be fun. I mean, like, I would be lying to say if that wasn't a goal or a dream on some level. When I see Bruce Springsteen or Tom Petty playing to that many people, I think to myself, like, yeah, it would be amazing to have this relationship with this many people and to get your message out to that many people and to connect with that many people. But you have to factor in the cost of that in today's cultural climate.
What I hear you saying is, if you separate music from a business or a culture or a phenomenon, you just want to live the life of an artist, whether you're writing a book or whether you're making a film or whether you're writing a song or touring, you just want to be able to have that experience of living a life as an artist. And your requirement is not that you have to get rich from it or anything like that.
No, I mean, I feel like the luckiest guy on the planet that I get to sit on a bus till soundcheck and read or watch a movie or listen to a record. I think a big part of living of life as an artist is being in love with art, that's where I get all my fulfillment from. Sometimes it's like, well, like, I think all artists have that one thing in common of, I don't know exactly how this is happening, it's just happening. I guess, like, when I think of what it means to live the life of an artist, for me, it's a big part of it is just trying to take in as much as I can at all times and then just hoping for the best.
Well, it's funny because I think that, you know, knowing your songs, you are a very introspective guy who likes to shift the camera angle around and look at the relationship from all sides. And you know, I just assumed, just based on what comes out of you, that I could see you maybe torturing yourself a little bit through the writing process and wanting, but more than that, I hear this desire to be honest and this desire to really, really get it to the point where it's authentic. And that from your first record, I think that was very apparent. And I think that when you have such lofty heroes, it can be daunting to, yeah, to say, okay, I'm going to put a record out there. And the people I like are John Lennon and Bob Dylan and Warren Zevon and Leonard Cohen. It's like you're naming the greatest poets, yeah, from that world.
Yeah, but it's like, you know, and I will always revere them and always idolize them in a way that I could never attain for my own, like, you know, impression of myself, obviously. But I think to give up of ever being that good, you're kind of already hanging it up. You're already,
sure,
done. I think unless you have your standards as high as possible, you're doing yourself a disservice. And sometimes, like you said, it can be really daunting and it can be really scary because even if someday someone is as good as Bob Dylan, you're not going to ever be as good as Bob Dylan because at this point he's an abstraction.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's funny talking to you. I hear themes that repeat that, you know, this idea that you want to wear your heart on your sleeve. You want to set your sights as high as you can. And then in some way put yourself in a bubble and try to let your own voice come out, right? And it's, man, it's a hard thing to do. And it's especially hard to do it, I think, you know, to be as personal thing as a songwriter. And a songwriter that's saying, I feel this, I see this. You know, it's in some ways the most naked art there is, you,
yeah,
know? And, I kind of want to finish up with one more song. It's another early song, but it kind of sums up that whole idea of you sort of taking the long view and trying to look at not just look at something from today, but as an entire, you know, how this song has a life and how you have a life and how those things match up. So, and the song I'm talking about is Bedside Manner.
Oh, cool.
Which, so let's listen to that as a way to kind of close off.
There's sometimes a much older man I will sit down and put on this song. It just might make me cry, or at the very least a tear in my eye.
Yeah, I hear that song as such a plea for, you know, let me find my way, let me have the space to try to get this right and for myself. And yeah, I think it's more than anything, it's what I respond to in your particular songwriting is that there's not a lot of filters between who you are and what you're writing about. Even if you're writing about other characters or you know, taking inspiration from places other than your own life. And it's something that, you know, it's not that easy to find in this day and age as a songwriter that you can connect with and you know, just feel like You're hearing some true thoughts, I guess.
Well, thanks.
It's a very inarticulate way to put it, but you know, I'm follow you closely because of that, and I think that you're doing just great work, and I hope that you just have the opportunity to keep doing it. You
know, thanks,
like,
man.
That you're able to keep making records because it's great, and I really appreciate you sitting down and doing this with me. It's really
awesome.
Nice.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
So that's our show. I really hope you enjoyed it. And if you want to take part in the entire off-camera experience, you have to go to offcamera.com. You can get the app. You can watch full HD versions of our television show. You can subscribe to this podcast and hear from all of our guests. And we even make an exclusive magazine, which has a bunch of photographs and things that you won't find anywhere else. It really is an interactive experience that we put a lot of work into, so take some time and check it out at offcamera.com. You can also find me on Twitter at Sam Jones. And if you want to check out my photography and directing work, you can go to samjonespictures.com. There's some fun stuff there to check out. And I love hearing from listeners. So if you feel like dropping me a line and commenting on the show, send me an email. I'm at sam@offcamera.com. I'm your host, Sam Jones, signing off. Thanks for listening.